One. Hey, everybody. Dave Hodges here. I'm the host of the Common Sense Show. We are the show that is freeing America, one enslaved mind at a time. Thank you so much for joining us. And we would ask you to continue to share our work. And my personal thanks to all of you who've given us such a high rating on Listen Notes. We're ranked in the top 0.5% of all podcasts in the world. And it's because of you guys and because you're sharing. So I want to know from the bottom of my heart, we truly appreciate that. We're humbled by your attention. We're coming to you live from the Noble Gold Studios. And you know my background here. I've been a customer of Noble Gold for 7.5 years, multiple times, and I have been an advertiser for 8.5. And I have to tell you, although there's no guarantees, they're the best people to deal with. No pressure, no call centers. They're just going to give you info. And you know the banks can take your money. They can take your retirement if it's in the bank under Dodd-Frank 2010. Don't let them do that. Don't even risk it. Noble Gold can help you out of that. For more information, go to DaveHodgesGold.com. That's DaveHodgesGold.com. Or call 877-646-5347. 877-646-5347. We have such an interesting guest here, and this is going to be an interesting journey. And I'm going to read directly from the biography of our guest, Andrea Widberg. And this is absolutely an incredible background. That you would think that Andrea, with her background and my background, we'd be on the same side on many issues, and we are. Listen to this, ladies and gentlemen. Andrea is the managing editor of American Thinker, which great publication, and has been with that site since 2020. She's a former Democrat who was raised in San Francisco and received a BA from UC Berkeley and then received a JD from the University of Texas at Austin. She's worked as a lawyer in the Bay Area for 30 years, raised two kids. And she's appeared in many leftist-run courts, raising children against a culture hostile to childhood innocence. What a great expression that is. I'm going to have to remember that. I like that phrase. And she's witnessed the Democratic Party turn against Israel, along with shock therapy of 9/11. And it's made her re-examine her political beliefs, leading her to embrace constitutional conservatism. And her website, and we'll give it out again before the end, is American Thinker. Dot com. Andrea, such a pleasure to have you on. First time guest on the Common Sense Show. And this is really terrific. I really like the American Thinker. I've been exposed to it several times, and you guys do fantastic work. You really do. I'm just curious, how much interference do you guys get from the powers that be that aren't happy with what you produce?
We don't get interference. Our founder and editor emeritus, Thomas Lifson, because the interference would come from the right, correct? Because we're not a huge player like Fox News or Newsmax. It would come from people pushing us from the right. But Thomas Lifson always rejected the sugar daddies of big conservative money. And in that way, he kept his editorial independence. And so we editors, we do some of our own writing, and we also review contributions from volunteer writers, and we are guided by our political moral compasses and our information about the facts.
As it should be. As it definitely should be. Well, let's jump right into the topics here. You argue that there's a connection between illegal immigration and violent crime, and it's no longer coincidental, and there's data points. And Andrea, by way of introduction, part of my teaching assignment when I was teaching community college, and university level, is I taught research and stat along with psychology. So I'm a data guy, and data is missing in the mainstream media, tremendously missing. And because I'm thinking, how do you arrive at that conclusion? So let's talk about that data point here between the relationship between illegal immigration and violent crime.
Well, I'm careful to say there have been no deep studies of which I'm aware, but what is it? The plural of anecdote is data, and eventually the plural of data is statistics, and statistics can be manipulated. But we humans are smart enough to note patterns. It's how we've survived for tens of thousands of years. And one of the patterns that one can't help but notice is that when illegal aliens move into a community, crime escalates. Now, part of that is simply the correlation of crime and poverty. Impoverished people tend to have more criminal activity. I'm not qualified to opine on why that is, what's cause, what's effect, just saying it's a fact. But one of the things that really caught my attention was that last fall, right before the election, it came out that in Aurora, Colorado, which is a suburb of Denver, many apartment complexes had been taken over by the Tren de Aragua gang, which is a gang headquartered in Venezuela. And Venezuela has had two administrations that are actively hostile to America and have made it a point that they wish to destabilize America. And the media first denied that Tren de Aragua was doing anything in Aurora, and then finally they had to admit it. Donald Trump came out and said, "This is an enemy invasion. This goes beyond just the people coming to America for to escape poverty," which I would do if I could. But as the American from in the country to which they're escaping, if you want to do that, you do it legally, the way people have done for over 100 years. You go through the channels, you get a sponsor so you won't become a leech on society. You go through health checks, you come through ports, you don't just stream into the nation. But it's very clear that Venezuela, just as Cuba did, used America as a dumping ground for its criminals, both to clean out its own country and to destabilize America as part of the socialist war on America. So Donald Trump correctly identified Tren de Aragua as part of Venezuela's destabilization campaign against America. That's a foreign nation waging war. So he said, "Hey, the Alien Enemies Act applied and rounded them up." Don't get me started on what the Supreme Court did. I'm going to focus on the crime.
Yeah, I know.
So
I hear you. I hear you. By the way, I'm from Aurora, and
oh.
that's my hometown, and I still have family there. And I'll tell you something that's not in the media. At the one of the targets nearby downtown Aurora, where this was going on Colfax, the takeover of apartments, they were holding nightly organizational meetings, dividing up into squads, and they were weaponized. And one of my friends from high school, who knows what I do, called me, and he was telling me all this. And he says, "We got out of there very quickly, and we don't go to Target at night." This is very, very serious. And there is some stats that support what you're saying. Venezuela's violent crime went down 75% in the year following TDA coming here. And violent crime in areas where it went, like in Aurora, escalated tremendously. I forget the number, but it was well over 30%.
Well, it may have been more than that because after Donald Trump's ICE raided Aurora and rounded up all these, excuse me, these Tren de Aragua people, they now have the first quarter st crime statistics for the Denver metro area, which includes Aurora, and homicides are down nearly 60%. That's a rather staggering decrease. And the police chief did the whole thing of, "Oh, our policing is so much better." Maybe it is. Correlation and causation are not the same. There's a great website that just has charts of spurious correlation and causation connections. Like the more chihuahuas you have in the household, the lower the divorce rate, or something like that. these numbers don't necessarily match. But so I couldn't reach a conclusion. I think your audience can reach its own conclusion. But on the very same day I saw that story, I saw an equally interesting story come out of the Canary Islands, which are off the coast of Africa, but they're technically part of Spain. And they are a way station for illegal aliens coming out of Africa and these illegal ali and heading towards Europe. And these illegal aliens are primarily from countries that are Muslim. So they come from Mali, which is 95% Muslim, Senegal, 96.6% Muslim, and Morocco, 99% Muslim. And so these people have landed on Canary Islands. And what's fascinating about the Canary Islands is that violent crime is surging in the Canary Islands. And let's see, homicides rose by 400% from and these aren't huge numbers because it's a small island, but there were two cases in early 2024 in the first quarter to 10 in the first quarter of 2025. Attempted homicides nearly doubled. Sexual assaults increased by 11%. So in Catalonia, Spain, which has looked at the prison numbers, 91% of those in prison for rape are Muslims. Now, the problem with data out of Europe is that they have stopped reporting on people's immigration status, place of origin, or religion. So there are lies, damn lies, and statistics. And when you can't even doctor the statistics, you stop collecting the data. And so it's very difficult to get information, but there seems to be just an incredibly strong correlation. And one of the other things you notice, for example, Venezuela, for the past few years, it has been the highest crime nation in the world. Something that dropped when it sent trend to Aragua to America. The fact is, when you send people from countries that are inherently violent to the West, they bring their violence with them. And when you deliberately send your most violent people, you're going to dramatically increase the numbers. And this is simply the nature of legal immigration. But I'd be happy to discuss with you a little factor, which is why the left won't acknowledge this. And it's not always ideology, it's also lies, damn lies, and statistics meshed with ideology.
Well, I know about the polls, just for example, and you can front load polls by a misrepresentative sample. You can do a number of things to taint the stats. But I do agree with you. There is a complete ignoring of the stats across multiple media domains in Europe and here. In fact, in Europe, they'll leave it. If you make a Facebook post that they don't like, they'll come and put you in jail. And particularly in the UK. In fact, actually, the UK threatened to extradite Americans saying negative things about them. So yeah, I hear what you're saying. And I think there's no question you can't bring in people that aren't trained, have a third grade education. They don't have substantial resources to maintain themselves over a long period of time, and they could even have families. How are they going to meet their needs? That's
This is correct. And the Muslim immigrations come from cultures that view Western women. There used to be a terrible old trope here, even in the West, that a woman who was raped was probably asking for it. You know,
Yes.
she wore a dress that was cut too high or cut too low or was in the wrong place at the wrong time. I would say there's still an element of that. If you go into a biker bar and do a striptease on the pool table, bad things will probably happen. It doesn't mean that the people who did it are free from the moral and criminal stain of having assaulted you, but hey, you know, we lock our doors at night for a reason. The thing with the Muslim immigrants coming to the West is that they are taught that all Western women, simply because they are not Muslim and because they are not wearing whether the hijab over their head or the full burqa or something, are prostitutes, and that they are unpaid prostitutes, and that they can be criminally assaulted, which is why rape has soared all over Europe. Everywhere in Europe, rape has gone up. And where we still have data, we know they're in prison. Islam also has the concept of jizya, which is that unbelievers owe Muslims, that it's simply Muslims really shouldn't have to work or do anything. And so you are free to take it. So the crime and the rape are almost a religious imperative, and they're certainly a cultural norm when it comes to non-Muslims. So when they come to America or to Europe, they don't think, well, now I'm in this country, I have to abide by their norms. They simply bring their norms with them. And because the leftist establishment refuses to do anything about assimilation, and in fact, in many places is lowering criminal sanctions against immigrants because they just don't understand and it's their culture, they know that they have a free hand.
Yeah, well, we're seeing the same arguments surface here. And it's even embedded itself in our education institutions. For example, in Minnesota, they're being sued by Judicial Watch because they have differential standards for discipline for teachers based on race alone. And it's coming here. 20 years ago, I was called a conspiracy theorist because when I looked at what was happening in Sweden, France, Germany, and the UK, and beginning here in America, I said, it looks like in a global attempt to destabilize the Western democracies and destroy culture and erase national boundaries. And I was called a conspiracy theorist. How would you respond to that today in 2025?
I would say I agreed with you 20 years ago. So I enthusiastically support what you're saying because you and I noticed the pattern then. We predicted the outcome, and the outcome has come to pass. So again, you and I are not, we haven't done broad-based studies of 10,000 people and reviewed criminal records from 30 nations. But again, humans with a minimal level of intelligence can look at facts and reach conclusions. I always say that conservatives look at facts and reach conclusions. Leftists have conclusions and retrofit their facts.
Yeah, that tends to be their MO. You know, like with Trump, show me the man, I'll show you the crime. And they do that with social issues as well. You're totally correct on that. And the bottom line is you get censored if you take this material on places like YouTube or Facebook. You can't tell the truth about this. When you look at what's happening in Europe and in here in the United States and also Canada, the common theme is what we just said, but what's the end game purpose and who's behind it? Have you thought about that?
I often think about it. I think there is an ideology behind it more than a single person. So there are hierarchies of believers. The people I know on my Facebook page, whom I've known for years from growing up in San Francisco, and I no longer live in the San Francisco Bay Area, but I raised my children there. I still count many friends there. And they're not idiots. They are people of intelligence and accomplishments. But they are useful idiots because they have accepted entirely the ideology and have folded it into their moral framework. And then you have the next level of people who simply see wealth and power. And then at the very top, you have people like George Soros or, and I've completely blanked, Klaus Schwab, the World Economic Forum person, who genuinely are like James Bond villains. And I couldn't even pretend to know what drives them, but they are driven. They are unbelievably intelligent. They despise the West, and they may truly be utopians who think that they can simply run the world better, or they could be complete nutcase totalitarian lunatics who are, as I said, James Bond villains.
It's really interesting when you start looking at motivations. But what we talked about this in our pre-air discussion a little bit. It's one thing for people to try to exploit these situations for their own gain, whether it's social, political, or economic. It's quite another to get the rank and file to go along with national suicide and making society less safe. What is it about the Democrats today that makes them so blind to what's actually happening and the threat that that poses to them?
One of the things I said is that the people in my world are people of accomplishment. Many of they're all college graduates. Those are the circles in which I was raised and grew up. Many of them have very high positions. Many of them are extremely wealthy. And when you really get down to it, the nexus is academia. And that academic nexus combined with a very specific Democrat ethos. Because when I was in law school, a California Democrat, I go to law school in Texas, and people were lovely to me. And I'd come out of UC Berkeley, which was even then entirely Democrat run, and I had hated every minute of my time at Berkeley. And it wasn't until much later that I understood that it was a clash of my values. Because my parents, even though they were Democrats, were old-fashioned Europeans with strong values with the leftist ethos. I just knew something was badly wrong at Berkeley. So then I go to Texas, and people are lovely to me, which was very weird because they're all conservatives. Conservatives are evil. I know that. I've been taught that. And that's where I first heard in the mid-80s the expression that Republicans think Democrats are misguided. Democrats think Republicans are evil. And it is the political manifestation or the manifestation simply of that old line from the 1960s. And I may get it backwards, but the personal is political. Or you could say the political is personal. But it's no longer about policies being good or bad for the economy, or good or bad for national security, or good or bad for your children. It's about good and bad. It's a Manichaean division of good and evil. You are a good person if you embrace Democrat politics. It is personal. You are an evil person if you embrace Republican politics. And that is what you still see today. And then they go off to college, the people in my world who become the movers and shakers, my children's peers who become the mid-level managers, and what they bring with them is what they're taught in college, which is borders are evil, white people are evil, Black people, as Brandon Johnson said, the mayor of Chicago, are inherently good and generous. Islam is a religion of peace, which is what George Bush parroted. And these are internalized beliefs that are tied into their sense of moral value. And that is almost impossible to change. That's why it took me from hating Berkeley when I left it in the early 80s to understanding by the 1990s that NPR was lying, to seeing 9/11 and understanding that it was the fruition of the combination of Islam and leftism, to another 2 years before I was able to make the break. So my journey took 20 years before I was able to say it is not evil to be a conservative.
Wow, that's a daunting statement. It took me 20 years. It's almost a depressing statement because you're obviously a person of good education, intelligence, and success, and it took you 20 years. And that really helps to explain where people who have less of those qualities than you do, are lifetime devotees. Although there is a shift, and I want to just go through one demographic with you. It's Latinos. And they're the fastest rising entrepreneurial class in America. And they're also the quickest shifting class from liberal to conservative politics now. We've seen the biggest shifts in them. Do you think it has to do with their Catholic upbringing, their family values? How would you explain that?
I don't think it's necessarily Catholicism. You know, Nancy Pelosi and Joe Biden are good Catholics. And
I wouldn't
my
call them
son,
good.
well, they are by their own definition. My son went to a Jesuit university, which I will not name, but the year he arrived there, they implemented their social justice program. They're a hard left institution that holds the line only on abortion. So I think for Hispanics, we had absolutely lovely Hispanic friends when I was growing up. They were very, very high caste, and that was what they told us. I have no idea about the caste system. They came, they had Spanish origins and blah, 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 but they were deeply involved with the Hispanic community. And one of the things they were trying to do at the time was to get more Hispanics to go to college because they said Hispanics want to work. They consider college a waste of time. And we're trying to convince them that if their kids go to college, they will rise faster economically, which is true. But I think, funnily enough, the Hispanic resistance to college may be what's insulated it from the disastrous ideas that colleges have been promulgating for decades now. There is a strong group within the Hispanic community that is focused on the real world, on facts, on the economy, on family, on everything but the malevolent, hardcore leftist ideas coming out of academia. And that may be part of what saved them. They live in the real world.
Interesting. Well, I think entrepreneurship has a lot to do with this too. It just when you see the street vendors, and I live north of Phoenix, rural Maricopa County. When you go into Phoenix and you see the street vendors, they're almost exclusively Latino, and they are very hardworking. They're very industrious, and many of them are very successful. And I really appreciate their work ethic and devotion to family, but it's been a big shift. But even African Americans, we're seeing a shift there. I saw a poll conducted by a conservative organization, it escapes my mind, but they were saying that 39% of black males approve of Trump's first 100 days. And you would never know that from watching the mainstream media.
And again, everybody in the mainstream media, college grad, usually boasting about their Ivy League credentials.
Yes.
The higher you go up the educational hierarchy, which is a great irony because it used to be that schools like Harvard, those were the white shoe schools and no minorities, no religious minorities, no racial minorities. And they were the backbone of the old line Republican Party. But they were also the backbone of the new Progressive Party. I think a lot of people forget that Woodrow Wilson, the first really leftist president. So Teddy Roosevelt was a progressive, but he was still an old school guy. Woodrow Wilson was president of Princeton University. I think most of FDR, Franklin Roosevelt's cabinet, came out of the Ivy Leagues. So already then, you were seeing this shift. And I love reading old books. And one of the classics, it's a lovely book. It's called Daddy Long Legs by Jean Webster. And it's a charming book about an orphan who goes to college and she writes letters and it's all very sweet. But what she calls herself is a Fabian. And if you look that up, this is in 1913 or 12. The Fabians came out of the British upper class system
Yes.
and the American upper class system. They were hardcore socialists who recognized that a true revolution would see them off to the guillotine. So Fabianism, their logo was the wolf in sheep's clothing, that they were going to softly integrate communism into the Western system. And so it's always been academia. To me, this is maybe because I hated Berkeley so much. So I've got a bee in my bonnet and an obsession. But academia is the toxin, it spreads the communist toxin. And it was always there, but it's become completely open in the last 15 years.
You're one of the few people I've ever interviewed that talk about Fabians. It's a phrase I've used quite a bit, Fabian socialism. And to me, the scariest element of it, and professed right from the top of this philosophy, it's one of the five pillars of sociology. And that if you don't put more into society than you take out, you should be done away with. You mentioned guillotines, euthanasia. The euthanasia movement in Canada is reflective of that philosophy. And we're beginning to see those arguments surface here in the Northwest in places like Washington and Oregon and California. And it's downright scary. And that's why I try to tell young people that think that socialism is a good idea. I said, it's not socialism, people. It's Fabian socialism. And you better be really productive and loyal to the state or you don't have a future. And
Well, absolutely true. And Hitler actually got his idea for euthanasia and eugenics from the American socialist movement and from the Fabians, who adored Hitler, although it became covered up very quickly later, was George Bernard Shaw,
yes.
because he loved how Hitler was euthanizing, he put it more tactfully, something something, but the mentally incompetent. I always say I come from a mixed family. Part of my family was a very old German Protestant going back to the Hanseatic Trading League. And part of my family is Jewish. And I always boast that we've been kicked out of every country in which we've ever lived because we got kicked out of France when we were the Christian side. And we got kicked out of here and there on the Jewish side. But also both sides of my family were killed in the Holocaust, because on the Jewish side, they were executed because they were Jewish. On the Christian side, they were executed because two of my relatives had a bipolar disorder. And so they were amongst the first. Hitler liquidated them in 36 or 37.
Yeah. Well, I'm the descendant of people that put on their tennis shoes and ran for their lives from Germany. In fact, back to our discussion of immigration, when my ancestors came here, and I grew up hearing these stories from my grandmother and great grandmother, my great aunt, that when they came into Ellis Island, they had to agree to a 7-year naturalization period. They had to pass tests on American history, American government, and be able to demonstrate some proficiency level with English. Or they didn't become citizens. And there was a complete move to assimilate people in that regard. And even our early public education system, devised by Rockefeller, Carnegie, and the rest, even they wanted people to assimilate. They wanted to limit their education so they couldn't question authority and get that smart to do so. But they still wanted them to be assimilated. And today it's like there's anti-assimilation. Why do you think that's true? Is it to promote the discourse and the violence?
It is part of the loathing of Western culture that comes from the left. In a way, you could say that we are still in the late 18th century. One of the things I like to point out is that the Democrat Party, which considers itself progressive, is completely regressive because so many of its tropes are locked in the mid 20th century. It treats abortion as if it's still coat hangers in the back alley instead of birth control in every shopping aisle. And now you can get the morning after pill at your local drugstore. Just walk in and buy it. And there's every Hollywood star has 8 kids out of wedlock and all sorts of stuff. So the stigma of illegitimate pregnancies and the risk of the multiple pregnancies that used to kill women, those are all gone. But that's how the Democrats still speak. They still speak about race as if Orville Faubus is at the courthouse door and George Wallace is talking about segregation today, tomorrow, and forever. Well, that hasn't been America since the 1970s. So on every metric, their arguments are still locked in the past feminism. Women are still barefoot, pregnant, and in the kitchen. And Hillary Clinton is saying that if a female Republican is elected, it'll be a patriarchy because, her husband will be controlling her. I mean, it's ludicrous. But where we really are locked is at the end of the 18th century, because the end of the 18th century saw two revolutions that still control all political discourse today. The first was the American Revolution, which is framed around individual liberty, limited government, and the notion of inherent individual rights. And also borders, national defense. I call myself, as I said, a constitutional conservative. It is my guide. We, over the centuries, implemented it badly sometimes. Slavery is a stain on a nation that believes in individual liberty, but humans are imperfect. The Constitution is probably the best political document ever written, with the best goals that accommodate human needs and human failings. But the other revolution that was going on was the French Revolution, and it was the slogan was Liberté, égalité, fraternité, liberty, brotherhood, and equality. And so people conflate it with the American Revolution, but it was vastly different because it really was the first socialist statist revolution. They simply overthrew the monarchy in favor of a collective, a state collective. And that was a, and Europe's been that way ever since. There's never been real liberty in Europe. Europe has always gone from one form of totalitarianism to another. It just went from monarchy to aristocracy to statist collective, and it's been more mild or more harsh. But what people forget is that while America was a nation founded under God, which means that we are not the top dogs. There is a moral arbiter above us. There are a set of moral rules that are above man-made rules, the Ten Commandments and the Noahide laws. These are, most people are familiar with them, and these are greater than man-made law. The French Revolution was radically anti-God. Diderot, the philosopher, one of the main philosophers of the French Revolution, dreamed that the last king would be strangled by the entrails of the last priest, because they recognize that the greatest threat to totalitarian government is people who say that is against the law of God, is people who say God's law trumps your law on these big issues. Hitler, people forget, they think he was Christian. He was pagan. Hitler hated the church. The Nazis hated the church. They used some of the churches the same way the Soviet Union used the Russian Orthodox Church. But what it boils down to, and I've actually forgotten your question because I've gotten on a high horse,
Oh, no, you're
but a
doing
large
good.
part of the hatred is against people. It is a war on God. And to the extent America, the founders were either Christians or deists who said that our Constitution is made for a godly people, all of this. And I was raised secularly, but I was raised in a home that I was very biblically knowledgeable and raised in a home bounded by biblical ethics. And my parents were among the naive generation that thought you can just hand those ethics down without handing God down. But you cannot have the ethics without the God, because otherwise it just becomes, well, why should I do that? Because I said so. You have to believe in God. And America has traditionally been in a country deeply associated with God right from the pilgrims. And so America, and this is why the incredible hatred for Israel. Israel is imperfect, like all human institutions, but Israel is the heartland of God. It's where the Bible came from. It is the Moses was the progenitor, Abraham and Moses. And so Israel and America must be destroyed, because they stand for something. No matter the humans involved, no matter the imperfections of our system, they stand for something greater than the state.
You know, all of these discussions, if carried out to its logical conclusion, end up in the same place. We're ultimately talking about good versus evil, spiritual war.
Yes. And again, I was raised secularly. Even now, I'm not a deeply religious person. I am, however, someone who believes deeply in religion, because I am a history major and I understand that the Bible, both the Old and New Testaments, are, without doubt, as Dennis Prager has said, especially of the Ten Commandments, if you implement these principles of justice and what I always think of Christianity of grace, if you implement these rules, you will have the safest, most decent, best, and most prosperous society. And also, the Bible is big on borders. Big on borders, on sovereignty, on national security. So everything that the Bible stands for is everything the left attacks. They attack borders, they attack God, they attack the rules of the Ten Commandments, they attack sexual, I'm blanking again on the word, but the stability of the male and female relationship. They attack the most fundamental principle of our human creation, which is male and female. Everything ultimately is a war on the Bible. And this is why the embrace of Islam, because Islam, even though Muhammad borrowed liberally from the Bible, Islam is also a rejection of the Bible. It is, Islam recognizes Judaism and Christianity as its enemies. And Islam and leftism are making common cause now because the enemy of my enemy is my friend. If they are able to erase Israel, America, Christianity and Judaism, they will go to war against each other. And in that one, I'm betting on Islam.
Let me guess. The manifestation you're probably referring to indirectly is what's happening to Jewish students on Ivy League campuses with regard to the Palestine movement.
Yes. And just generally, I've been watching for 30 years. One of the things I believe everyone has a truth. A truth is something you know to the core of the being, it is something people can't lie to you about. My mother's, funnily enough, my mother was a very beautiful woman, very fashionable, very chic. And when she came to this country, not long after they arrived here, the Kennedys came up. And Jackie Kennedy was so chic and French and European, stylish, and that appealed to my mother. And what my mother became a Democrat. And I kept saying to her after I had my conversion, you're seeing a lot of lying out of the left, out of the media. They're lying to you. My mother didn't believe it until the day they said that Michelle Obama was the new Jackie Kennedy. That was my mother's truth. And once you know you're being lied to, everything unfolds. And for me, again, it was a slower process, partly because I didn't have the 2010 me whispering in my own ears. In the 1990s, I'm still listening to NPR because I'm a good Democrat. I'm a college educated. I'm a lawyer. Of course, you listen to NPR. Loved NPR. But I knew they were lying about Israel. Again, I'm not saying Israel is imperfect. It is a liberal democracy that has all the flaws of a human society. But I knew a lot of the truths about Israel because my parents were part of it. And I've read books on it. Scholarly books, popular books, and NPR was very consistently lying. And I'd find myself screaming at the radio in the car, "You're wrong. That's a lie." And suddenly I thought to myself, "Wait a minute. If they're lying about this, what else are they lying about?" And then the internet came along, and I went and I looked at these things called blogs where people were able to. All sorts of thousands, tens of thousands of people were able to put out their ideas. And I looked at blogs across the political spectrum. I was very open-minded. I'm still a Democrat. And what I discovered very, very consistently is that as to all things, conservatives were honest. They were open about their biases, unlike leftist outlets. The New York Times still insists that it's objective, as does the Washington Post. Conservatives outlets were open about their biases, honest about their facts and comprehensive in their analyses. And Rush Limbaugh was, who loved American Thinker. He called American Thinker his show prep. Rush Limbaugh was at the apex of this absolute honesty about what he is thinking, what he knows, and how he analyzes it. And once I discovered this, it was a no-brainer.
No, that's a really, really good answer to this. Here's another thing that bothers me too about this whole paradigm, the left-right paradigm. I don't think there is a functioning Democratic Party any longer, and here's why I say that. I don't want MAGA or the Republicans to become a standalone party. Okay, I don't, that's unhealthy because eventually they'll become autocratic. We need a healthy Democratic Party to have a balance. Unfortunately, the Democratic Party stands for everything that Trump doesn't, and vice versa. And that's not a political party. That's just an antagonist movement.
Yes, and I see that on my Facebook page, which sometimes people ask to friend me, and I always say, sure, I'll take you as a friend, but I no longer post on Facebook. I'm not willing to provide content for them. But I check out my Facebook page regularly because of all these people I know from growing up who are Democrats. And they range from my favorite loopy leftist, who is just the mouthpiece of every crazy idea, to people who are much more moderate. But everything they post is about Trump is evil. Trump is awful.
Everything.
Trump is a convicted felon. There is no policy initiative that they can separate from Trump. He has become, oh, I'm thinking in 1984, George Orwell, when you have the 2 minutes of hate, which keeps people focused. He is their 2 minutes of hate, except he's their 24/7 hate.
Exactly.
That's all they've got.
And the message to a large extent has worn off. The effect, like I hear it, I go, here we go again. Here we go again. It's the same old worn out anti-Trump, even when it makes sense. Again, what we talked about in the very beginning, I don't, if I'm a Democrat or if I'm a Libertarian or a Republican, I don't care, but I don't want a pedophile released from jail living in my neighborhood. I don't want illegal aliens who know nothing but crime and they were in prison in their home country for crime. I don't want them roaming our streets. And they have convictions, they should be deported. And to me, self-preservation said everyone would get on board with that. But these people are, I'm trying to think of the right term here. They're working against their own best interest of their family safety by the political positions they're taking.
Well, there are 2 points I'll make on that because, again, I know the world of the. I mean, because the Democrat Party now is made up of two people. It's made up of the welfare class, which is utterly dependent on government, and it's made of the academic class. And the
Yes.
important thing to remember about the academic class is that they live in neighborhoods where they're completely isolated, they're insulated from their own policies. And it was very weird in my community because all the families were consistently having conservative values. They got educated, they got jobs, they got married, they had children, they stayed married. I gr raised my children in an absolutely fabulous community. I called it Leave It to Beaverville because every home was a 1950s perfect paradigm. Having said that, every one of them embraced leftist policies because that's what was good, going back to this Manichaeism of good versus evil. But they were also able to maintain that because our neighborhood was safe. We had unlocked doors. The kids ran up and down the streets. There were no pedophiles. There were no there were there was one home break-in in the 23 years I lived there. Totally insulated. And in fact, in one of the rare moments of insightful humor in 2017, after Trump's first election, Saturday Night Live did a thing about the bubble. If you're unhappy, we are doing a development. It is the bubble. And within the bubble, everything will be perfect. It will be the validation of all your beliefs. And it was quite funny. It had, you can have insightful political discussions, goes the voiceover, and you see two people sitting there saying, well, I agree with you. Oh my gosh, I agree with you. And just going back and forth, and how it's this perfect thing where everything is organic and every color and gender and non-gender and everything is equally honored. And then at the end, they say one bedroom, one bathroom units are now available for $1.7 million. And that's the bubble.
Well, I would call it the prison. Back to academia for a second here, and I want to talk about a solution. And I'll just give you a case in point. Arizona State University. The president of Arizona State University is a former CIA operative. He's best friends with Barack Obama. So you know what kind of policies he carries in. His name's Michael Crow. I don't dislike the man personally. I actually think he's done some decent things for the community, but his philosophy that gets embedded into students. You believe in climate change the way we tell you, or we'll flunk you. And this is an attitude that is pervasive in this university. How do we overcome this conquering of our education system?
Well, first of all, your point about him being a nice person, that's one of the problems. The people I knew were nice people. A lot of leftists are nice people. They're driven by emotions because they're nice people. Regarding academia, I think Trump is on the right track, which is you pull the financial plug. What we're discovering with Doge and with Trump's going after academia is that taxpayers have been paying for most of this craziness. The street protests, I don't know if you've noticed, but there are almost no street protests against Trump's initiatives. When there are, it's a bunch of white people in their 70s carrying homemade signs. What was getting people out were these organizations. And with Trump having pulled the plug on the flow of money, they can't get people out. They can't have the pre-printed signs. They can't have the nice little piles of bricks in case anybody should feel inclined to throw them, not that they're telling them to. And it's the same with academia. Trump is bringing academia to heel. And a young man I know who is a leftist said to me, "Isn't that anti-science?" I said, "No, because for one thing, you cannot have science within a totalitarian environment. You cannot have science when you are discriminating against people based on race, color, and creed. That is either driving Jews out or inviting people into academia who are distinctly unqualified because they claim that they're the opposite sex or that they have a certain skin color. That is anti-science. That is anti-intellectual." But the other thing I said is since I graduated from college in the early 80s, faculty and student ratios have remained the same. What's gone up by 500% is administration, so that you can have your assistant to the queer studies department chair. And I said, you can just, money's fungible. If they're pulling 400 million, fire a bunch of your assistants to the assistants and your useless departments that are all about advancing leftism. Or do what I believe it was the president of one of the universities, maybe Harvard, don't quote me, agreed to a 25% salary cut from 1 million to 750,000. There is no reason for the thought leader institutions, which sadly places like Yale and Harvard with their endowments that are bigger than the whole GDP of small countries, should be getting any federal money at all. And if you take away the money, there is no one more invested in money and the meaning of money and the power of money than a communist. If you take money away from communists, you take the air out of their balloon.
I'm so glad too you're an attorney, and I couldn't agree with more with what you just said. And I agree, cutting off the money is the first big step. But with regard to the judiciary, we see federal district court judges ruling in their area, but also nationally against the Trump administration's policies. And I'm wondering here as a layman, as not a lawyer, how is it legal for a federal district court judge to set national policy?
Well, it isn't. And where I litigated for 30 years in the San Francisco Bay Area. I didn't do a lot of federal litigation. I hated doing federal litigation because of all the regulations, the 175,000 pages or something like that of regulations, because you were up against a government attorney who knew his chapter and you're trying to learn it and you're dealing with it. So we, as attorneys who weren't specialists, dealt with exactly the same thing as the layperson who's in the crosshairs of the federal government. It's pure Leventi Beria, show me the man and I'll show you the crime, the regulations, and Trump has taken a stand against it, and it's one of the smartest, best things he can do. Apropos the judges, I had a judge tell me, "I don't care what the law is, I think there's something here." I had another judge, when he was shown that the law simply wouldn't support him, say, "Well, there's more than one way to skin the cat." And when I was sworn into the San Francisco bar, there was a federal judge who was one of the judges at this giant swearing in. There were like 500 people in a big auditorium. And the person who was a master of ceremonies said, "And on my right is Judge so-and-so of the federal district court." And Judge so-and-so guffawed and said, "That's the first time anybody's described me as being on the right." So I was in the heart of it. What I can tell you about leftist judges is that the law is a skin suit. They already have their preferred outcomes, which are based on communist class metrics. I represented banks and businesses, and we simply lost going in. The thing was to stem the loss, and the law didn't matter. They do what Ruth Bader Ginsburg and other leftist judges do in their decisions, which is to throw a bazillion case citations at you to confuse you. It's just throwing so much that you can't see the through line, which is that they're making it up as they go along. Roe v. Wade, penumbras and emanations. The Constitution doesn't have penumbras and emanations. This started with Chief Justice John Marshall, who was virulently anti-Jeffersonian, and he and Jefferson got into a a political fight about political appointees. And it was in that context that Marshall arrogated, took for the Supreme Court the power to make all constitutional decisions. That is not in the Constitution. Arguably, the only way to decide if a law is good or bad, or even constitutional or unconstitutional, is through the voters, through their elected representatives. So I have a problem overall with the federal courts and the power they claim for themselves.
But it's
Up
not
until
legitimate power, though. I mean, if I'm a federal district court judge in, say, District 9, whatever it is, my rulings apply there. They don't apply
That's right.
3, 4, 5, 7, and 12. They don't.
Right. Cases and controversies. It's supposed to apply to the people in front of the court.
Yes.
And then traditionally, if enough different jurisdictions started interpreting the law differently as to the case and controversy in front of the court, then it would rise up to the Supreme Court, which in its John C. Marshall, Chief Justice Marshall wisdom, would do a global constitutional analysis.
Exactly.
And this system actually worked honestly right up until the era of progressive judges, when they started politicizing them. I mean, I am so hostile to leftist judges and courts, but you have to understand that they are not arbiters of the law. They are politicians who use the law to advance their political philosophy.
Yeah.
And the problem is, unless Congress acts, and this Congress, which has a very narrow margin, Republican margin in both the House and the Senate, unless Congress acts, the only thing that Trump can do, and this is what the left wants him to do, is refuse to abide by decisions which will create a constitutional crisis. And average voters do not want a constitutional crisis. So the left is waiting for the headline saying Trump creates constitutional crisis.
I hear you.
And then the average
agree.
People will turn on him. So Trump has no good options here. Congress has to act, and Congress so far has not acted.
See, that's my point. We have low-hanging fruit from individuals that committed heinous crimes under the Biden administration that are known and could be prosecuted, and they're not. And Congress isn't even taking legislative action against closing those loopholes. And then Congress could impeach judges or cut off their funding, like Boasberg, who's trying to be a Supreme Court justice of one. And they don't do it. And it just drives me up the wall. And Congress is the one failing to act. I think Congress and the pressure point on Congress is the key to turning around a lot of this stuff. I'll just give you one short example in the time we have left. You have the American Inn of Court, and I researched this. You got Ketanji Brown, Sotomayor, but you also have the Supreme Court Justice, the head of the Supreme Court's in this, and I believe Amy Coney Barrett is too. And I'm thinking, okay, why are you guys who are breaking the Constitution from different political backgrounds, supposedly, why are you in one organization?
Well, they would say collegiality, but a quick thing regarding impeachment won't work because you need, is it a 2/3 or 3/4 majority to impeach?
Yeah.
And that the Congress can't sustain that, but they do have a majority for passing legislation that constrains the district court judges, and they need to do that. As for the Supreme Court justices, they would say collegiality, we have to work with each other,
yeah,
it's helpful to blah, blah, blah. But basically what it is that the judges are, the Supreme Court justices, especially the leftists, again, are highly political animals who see the Supreme Court as a way of advancing political goals.
Yeah.
And you and I are beginning to think that maybe Roberts and Coney Barrett and Kavanaugh and Gorsuch might be on board with that. And, you know, they came out of the Federalist Society, which I've always honored and admired. But I'm beginning to think, wait a minute, you guys, you need to do some better vetting here.
Yeah, well, especially Coney Barrett. What a deception she was. Very quickly, we got about 30 seconds left. What about writ of habeas corpus as an option for Trump to overcome this?
I think that is an incredibly dangerous move. I have not researched it. Even now, scholars are debating how much authority Lincoln had under it, and anything I say would be stupid and misleading.
Okay, that's a fair answer, but I'm hearing that floated a lot out there. Even some of Trump's people have floated out there, and I think they're looking to see what the reaction would be. I think they're just testing the market. Okay, so you're the AmericanThinker.com. How do people follow you other than that? Is that your primary method of expression?
AmericanThinker.com, yes. And we're also on Facebook and on X. And again, Rush Limbaugh used to call us our show prep. So we get crowdsourcing of information from across the conservative world in editorial curated essays.
Well, I tell you, we got a lot in this hour. I so appreciate you coming on the Common Sense Show, and I hope you'll come back and visit again. Thank you so
It would
much.
be my pleasure.
Take
Thank
care,
you.
everybody.